Thank you, Harmon. I appreciate the introduction and the cheers from all of my Louisville fans up there. That's the only way to ever be a speaker, bring your own audience. You never know what you get from strangers. There's no such thing as a stranger in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's just a lot of friends that you've never met. And you get a chance through doing this to meet them. And I have a lot of friends all over Ohio, and I've seen a lot of them here and had a chance to laugh with them again, and it's just great. That's one of the advantages of being able to do this. And we were talking about it a little earlier. It's a shame more of you don't have an opportunity to do this, because I know you're just as qualified as anybody else that's around here, and just sometimes the opportunity never presents itself, and that's sad, but maybe we do something about that someday. I don't know. But I am glad to be here, and I appreciate the invitation, and getting to know you and meet you is the thrill of it all. I can honestly tell you I don't have an ego problem with this. It's just not one of those things that makes me think better or worse or lesser or whatever. It's just something that gives you a golden opportunity to share with people what was given to you and to meet a lot of new friends. And I'm eternally grateful for that. My name is Jack Sullivan, and I am an alcoholic. Don't holler that around the airport. You get there. I was walking through Stanford Field one day out in Louisville, at Louisville Airport, and across the hall, some guy hollered, "Hi, Jack!" And go, "Oh, God, I didn't think we'd ever get out of there." But my sobriety date in Alcoholics Anonymous is the 21st day of August of 1962. And my... I didn't intend for that to impress you, but it impresses the hell out of me, I can tell you that. My home group is the South Louisville group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a Wednesday night open speaker meeting in Louisville. I hope you ever have an opportunity to be in Louisville that you'll come by and see us. I think it's the finest home group in the world. If you don't have a home group, I suggest you get one. If you've got one and don't think yours is the finest, then my advice to you is just stay there. Don't go screw up somebody else's. You're probably right where you belong. I have an announcement. I don't know why in the hell they give it to me. It looks like they'd give it to the chairman. It's from the powers that be of Akron University. It says, in case of fire in this auditorium, the Al-Anons are to remain seated until the AAs have cleared. Now, don't get mad at me. They gave me the damn thing to announce. I had nothing to do with it, but I've enjoyed being here. We came in yesterday, and I really have enjoyed being here and listening to the other speakers, and some of them I already knew, and you got a fella coming on tonight that's a great friend of mine from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, George Ellison, and you want to show up because George carries a wonderful message, and you'll be glad you did when you listen to him, and I certainly enjoyed the old-timers panel. I think that's the backbone of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope it never ceases to be where they get the respect they deserve for what they've done for Alcoholics Anonymous. If it wasn't for them, you and I wouldn't be around here. And they're great guys, and I've known a lot of them over the years, and I've had favorites like everybody else. Everybody has favorite speakers they like to listen to, and that. And one of my favorite old-timers was Wino Joe Leach. If you've never heard of Wino Joe, he's deceased, but if you talk to the taper or go where he's around, see if he's got a tape of Wino Joe and buy it. You'll be enriched for the rest of your life. He was a follower of Dr. Bob Smith when Dr. Bob said, leave the Freudian complexes to the scientific minds. They have no place in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are simple people with a simple program that we learn well, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do it. I apologize to you today because I'm not working on anything. I wished I was. I might fit more in the mold of our society today, that where I'm always be working on something, but I'm not. My 12th step tells me that I should treat people nice. I come in a program where I grew up. My old friend of mine up in St. Louis, Paul Keebler, told me a mature individual was one who knew the difference between right and wrong and acted accordingly. I know the difference between right and wrong and try to act accordingly. Paul also told me that people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have a spiritual awakening are people who realize there's somebody else lives on this planet besides you. There's Almighty God and other people here, and you should live your life in accordance to what pleases God, is beneficial to others, and beneficial to yourself. That is not the way I used to live before I got here. And the total package and the work that you do is all set in an ending to where you become happy, joyous, and free. And I stand here today to tell you I've reached that point in my life. I'm happy, and I think the definition of happiness is wanting everything you have. In order to be happy, you must want everything you have. In order to be joyous, you must continue this program dedicated to the help of other people. And you must get joy in your life from seeing them get better. And having shared that with people, you understand the elation your sponsor had when he saw you get better. The happiness is within me, the joyousness comes from you, and the freedom is I am no longer enslaved to the bondage of self. No, I have been liberated. And I try to practice those principles in all my affairs. And I owe all of that to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I owe all of that to those old-timers who were here before me and some of my favorite people in the world. And you'll never forget them as long as I'm around because they won't let you. My old friend Wino Joe was quite a character. Joe believed in simplistic values that Dr. Smith believed in. I picked this 20 questions up over in that archives office today, and I thought of Joe. I believe those questions were written by a psychologist in Johns Hopkins University. And when they first appeared, Wino Joe got madder than hell. He said, why do you need a psychologist to ask alcoholics questions if they're alcoholics? Alcoholics ought to ask alcoholics if they're alcoholics. So Joe wrote his own. I have a list of them at home. One of them was, have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? You ever been run over by your own car while driving? You ever been arrested while in jail? Probably the best one Joe wrote is, have you mastered the art of puking out of a moving vehicle without it blowing back in? The interesting thing about that, when you stand there and ask those questions, is watch people in the audience going, yeah. They identify. But that's the way that it was. And that's what I grew up with, and that's what I share with you. And it was a wonderful time. AA has not changed. Some people, where I come from, it's alive and well and very healthy. I think sometimes people have changed, but that's okay. They finally wind up where they belong, and, you know, they see in a while that that's really not the thing to do, and they cool it, I think. You know, I had an old friend that was in AA about 15 years, and he moved up in the mountains. He lived in another town. He moved up in the mountains. He kind of became a loner up there, and he moved back down to the city, and he said to me one day, he said, boy, the people in AA really changed, haven't they? I said, what do you mean? He said, when I was younger, we did a hell of a lot of drinking in the basement, and now they do a hell of a lot of drinking in the attic. I said, what in the hell are you talking about? Well, he said, everywhere I go, I hear people say they're an alcoholic in the attic. I said, man, I ain't talking about in the attic. So whatever. Whatever. I had my wife with me. She's sitting back there. She's in Al-Anon. My old sponsor saw to that. He sent her there. Ruined my life forever. No, I'm kidding. You know, that, 'cause you learn to grow up there, right? Become an independent self. Happiness has other dimensions. People bring happiness into your life, but where would you be if there was nothing but you? And that's the bottom line question. I think that's what AA says, take responsibility for self. So does Al-Anon say take responsibility for self. My wife's been a member of the Al-Anon family groups for 33 years. She got in Al-Anon in 1963. I got married to her in 1963. And she got in Al-Anon that period of time. Fine lady, has one very bad quality I don't like about her, but I haven't been able to change it. She still thinks alcoholics lie. That kind of hurts. You know, I don't mind her thinking I'd lie, but we had a fellow down in Louisville who was a state delegate, and she accused him of lying. That's sacrilegious to accuse a state delegate of lying. You know, I said, don't you talk about Billy Moore like that. She said, Billy Moore's a bigger liar than you are. I'm going to tell you a story that Billy told me, and Billy said it was true. I believe him, and she don't. You decide. Billy Moore said he knew a woman that came to Al-Anon all the time. Her husband kept drinking, and he died. And when he died, she had him cremated and mixed his ashes with some marijuana and smoked him. And she went all over the country and told people that's the first time in 25 years that sucker ever made her feel good. Now, do you believe that? Yeah. There you are, Gay. I don't believe in telling jokes behind these podiums or lying. I'm telling you what Billy Moore said, and I believe it. Because Billy said he personally knew that woman. I came in AA in 1962 at the age of 33. I was the youngest member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the city of Louisville that stayed. Now, you can imagine that in today's society. At the age of 33, and them old geezers looked at you and wondered, what in the hell are you doing here, boy, at that age? You know, they knew that alcoholism had a physical bottom, and it took quite a while to get there. They had a measuring stick. If you had 9 teeth, a wristwatch, and could count up to 10, they wouldn't let you in. They figured you had to lose another tooth or your watch or something, you know. And 33 was an ungodly young age. And now look at them today, huh? 18, 19, 20, sometimes even younger. Right? And I don't care what anybody says, we got some damn good young AA members around the country, and we got them in Louisville, you know, and they're good. Yeah. You still got some old goats that don't think they belong here that young, but I had a fellow down in Louisville asked a young boy I sponsored one time how old he was, and that boy was 19. And that old man looked at him and laughed, said, 19? So I spilled more whiskey than you ever drank. That kid looked at him and said, maybe if you'd have drank some of it instead of spilling it, you got her quicker, you old bastard. I never set out to become an alcoholic. It's nothing I accomplished. You know, didn't have any reason to be an alcoholic. You know, I come from a nice home. I don't even think it was dysfunctional. My mother was a very sickly lady. She died when I was about 18, 19 years old, but she was sick all of her life. I never remember a day of my life that she was not sick. She had a blood disease, but she was a good woman. And my father was the assistant director of personnel on the old Louisville and Nashville Railroad in Louisville. He was a good man. I had an older brother who took advantage of a scholarship that was offered to our family and, went to General Motors Tech up in Flint, Michigan, got a degree in industrial engineering, and just recently retired as a General Motors executive. Made a hell of a good living all of his life, you know, and had two younger sisters who were absolutely normal as far as I know, and there was me. I don't think you know when them programs got to flitting around AA, you know, all of those ones that make you a victim. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous says you're responsible for your own reaction to any given situation. You may have been in a lot of situations you didn't create, but you had a certain reaction to them that brought on a lot of problems sometimes. You have to accept that responsibility. You were not a victim of anything. And that's what separates Alcoholics Anonymous from those victim programs. But when they started coming around to AA 10 or 12 years ago, it makes you think. I've got an old friend of mine out in North Carolina, and I called him one day. He's been sober longer than me. I knew he's smarter than me. I said, "Brian, I've been thinking." He said, "I'm real sorry to hear that." I said, "No, it's crossed my mind." I said, "Do you think it's possible that I came from a dysfunctional home?" He said, "Was you in it?" And I said, "Hell yes, I was in it." He said, "Is dysfunctional if you's in it? You could dysfunctionalize anything." So I give up being a victim. I was telling George and him coming over here, a guy gave me a tape of that song the Eagles wrote. Have you ever heard that song, Get Over It? And I can't understand them songs they sing anymore. I don't understand the words. They run too fast for me. So I sponsored a young boy, 21 years old, Lowell Hagen, and I said, "Hagen, take this tape and interpret it for me and bring it back to me." So he did, and the last verse of that song, I'm going to tell you what it was, about being a victim. It's called Get Over It. It says, "You drag it around like a ball and chain, you wallow in guilt and you wallow in pain. You wear it like a flag, you wear it like a crown, got your mind in the gutter trying to drag everybody down. Complain about the present and blame it on the past. I'd like to find your inner child and kick his little ass." So I quit being a victim. Did real well in life until I was about 15, 16 years old. I had pretty good. Yeah, some of y'all got in all that crap when you're six. You know, and I went to high school in Louisville called St. Xavier. It was a Catholic high school. I was a good student, made good grades. Didn't know anything about life except what you did when you were young. Went to school, went to church, prayed, did all that stuff. Pretty good basketball player. And there hadn't much money around our house. My mother's sickness took most of my father's salary, and there wasn't a lot of health insurance at that time. So we didn't have any money there. So I got me a job. And it was in a Gulf filling station out around 3rd and Central. 3rd, 4th, and Central is an interesting corner in Louisville, primarily because Churchill Downs Racetrack borders that corner. If you've never been to Louisville, you've probably seen the Kentucky Derby on television, and when they pan around there, that's where you are, with 3rd and 4th and Central. And I got out there in this Gulf filling station at night. I'm close to 16 years old. World War II is just about over, but everything is still rationed, including gasoline. And you couldn't buy it without ration coupon. Old people didn't use all their coupons all the time. At the end of the month, they'd come in there and give you the book. And we'd had a lot of stamps there that we hadn't pumped the gas for. And what it meant was there was a lot of gasoline down those tanks. You could sell them without ration coupon. There was guys around there who owned liquor stores and beer joints and had good whiskey and good beer, and you couldn't buy it over the counter during the war. And they'd come down there with those Cadillacs, and we'd fill them with gas. And they left good whiskey and good beer there, and we put it in a storeroom. And that's where I learned to drink, because we took that whiskey and beer and we either sold it or we drank it. And that's where I learned to drink. There was a guy across the street that owned a drugstore, had good cigarettes that you couldn't buy over the counter. He'd bring him Cadillacs over, we'd fill them with gas, and he'd leave the good cigarettes there, the Luckies, the Camels, the Chesterfield. We'd put them in a storeroom back there, and we either smoked them or sold them. And that's where I learned to smoke. And there was some girls over there that didn't have any gasoline. And you'll have to draw your own conclusions about that. There was a racetrack around there where there was some money to be made at that particular time. A lot of things went on that don't today because of film patrols and things. I'm 16 years old. I was a good student in St. X. I was almost finished with my sophomore year, and my life completely changed. I have absolutely no idea why that lifestyle was attractive to me. Sometimes you hear professional people say peer pressure. We are the peers. You know, we're the people that create the pressure most of the time. Because whatever gang I'm running with or whatever group I'm in, there's other groups there if I cared to join them. There's people still doing the right things, the nice things, the normal things or whatever. But I want to be in this, I want to be in here where they're doing what they're doing. You know, because now I have learned to drink, I have learned to smoke, I'm having sex, I got money in my pocket, and I don't want to hear about that other crap. I mean, this is where it's at, and this is where I want to be, where it's at. All my life, I always wanted to go where it was at. Seemed like every time I got there, it was gone, but I always wanted to be where it was at. You know, and I loved that lifestyle, and I'm absolutely honest with you when I tell you now, I do not know why. Why is that attractive to some people where normal living isn't? Why is that attractive to young people when getting a good education, which is so important in your life, isn't? I don't know. Wasn't attractive to my brother. He got an education. That lifestyle wasn't attractive to my sisters. They led normal lives. I loved every damn minute of it. And when I was finishing my sophomore year in that Catholic high school, the principal sent for me one day and he said, "We don't want you back here next year." I was not a drunk. I had an attitude problem. I resented discipline. I resented authority. I had now reached a point in my life where I didn't want anybody telling me what to do. And that damn near kept me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew enough about alcoholics to know they were people who had problems they couldn't handle. And if they wanted a solution to what was wrong with them, they had to reach out somewhere outside of themselves. And I was not the type of person that was very good at that. I knew it all. And I didn't want anybody telling me what to do, where to go, who to go with, and how long to stay. You know? And I had a lot of resentments for people that way, including those teachers. So I left that school and finished my high school education in a vocational school. I was beginning to have a hell of a time with my father. My father was a very strong man. I like to talk about my dad. My dad died in 1970, so I was sober 8 years before my father passed away, and I'm eternally grateful for that. We became the very best of friends, my dad and I. We could talk about anything and many things. But my father believed that you have to pay the fiddler if you dance to the music. My father believed if you're looking for a helping hand, it's on the end of your own arm, provided you know where to put it. And my father regretted that neither one of us ever knew where to put it. But my father would not contribute to my delinquency, nor would he pay for my problems. And I used to tell him, "I didn't give a damn. I don't need you, old man. Leave me alone." And the only thing that ever changed my opinion of my father was when I was 20 years old, I was arrested for the very first time. It's interesting. Jails have a way of changing your opinion of people. You know, I don't know why that is, but you can go down on the corner tonight and listen to some guy talk about that old bitch he lives with. Lock him up. You know, he'll call and she'll answer and he'll say, "Honey, yeah, honey." Jail did that. I was in there. I'm 20 years old. I was arrested for public drunkenness and disorderly conduct. Sitting in that jail cell, they give you one phone call, and I dropped a dime in that phone back then. I didn't have anybody else to call but him, and he answered. And he wasn't a dumb old man anymore. Because when he answered, I said, "Daddy? Daddy?" I can hear him now. And this really exemplifies what kind of man my father was. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I'm in jail." He said, "Well, why'd you call me?" I said, "Well, I thought maybe you'd come down here and get me out." "Oh," he said, "I wouldn't worry about that if I was you." Well, I was worried about it. He said, "As smart as you are..." "Oh," he said, "I'm sure if you figured a way to get in, you'll figure a way to get out." And he left me there. And I crossed paths with him somewhere along the way when I got out, and he said to me, "I've never been in jail, never. I understand they give you one phone call. If I was you, I wouldn't waste it." Well, I never called him anymore. He didn't have any understanding of the problem. And when I came to AA and made amends to my father, and I did, and it was a great period of time in my life when my dad and I sit down and talk about the real me. And it's very painful for any alcoholic, and it's the thing that kept me going all the time was the inability to see me for what I was. But I said to my father, you know, one damn question I don't have to ask you is how much I owe you. It was nothing. I mean, he never contributed a nickel, not one nickel. Well, I rolled along for 13 years for the sake of time, and I did everything that every alcoholic I have ever met tries to do. I tried to find some way to live in that world out there where I was happy, joyous, and free, where I was comfortable, where I had peace of mind and a little serenity in my life. I wanted to be in that environment with those people doing what they did with no problems. They were my kind of people. I tell people all the time, the only phase of my life that has never changed is I have always associated with people just like me. All of my life, I have been with people just like me, and I still am here today. And that has never changed, and it never will. But back then, when I would get in trouble and get out of it and get sober to some degree, or not drinking to some degree, I began to try to live in that world out there sober. And the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, tells me that I immediately became restless, irritable, and discontented. Hey, that describes me to a T. There's nothing else that needs to be said. I wanted to be over there with them, doing what they did, acting like a tough macho guy. And when I knew I had better stay out of there, I became very restless, irritable, and discontented. And I couldn't stand that kind of feeling very long. It was only a matter of time till I was right back over there and in it. I don't have to tell you that. And nobody ever had any offer of help or solution at that time in my life. I never crossed paths with anybody that knew anything about alcoholism. They were all threatening as to what was going to happen to me if I don't quit drinking. You know, what a waste of time. If you ran into a Catholic priest, which what I did, he said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to hell. Our family doctor said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. My boss at the railroad said, you're going to the unemployment lines. My father said, you're going to get out of my house. The policeman says, you're going to jail. The judge says, you're going to the penitentiary if you don't quit drinking. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, put all that garbage aside. What we're going to do, we're going to address the fact of what happens to people like you when you do quit drinking. You don't do well sober by yourself in the isolation of your own mind. And for some reason, you don't have the inability to reach out. Or you don't have the ability to reach out. And that's what destroyed me until I was 33 years old. As smart as I was and as much as I knew, I was able with great zeal and determination to work myself all the way to Skid Row, living on the city streets of Louisville as a wino for about a year and a half. I shouldn't say that. A friend of mine in Indiana said, never tell anybody you're a wino. There's no such thing in AA. You're not a wino. You're an alcoholic that ran out of money. Oh. I'm here tonight to tell you I was never a wino. I was an alcoholic that ran out of money. Skid Row is not a very interesting place to be. Skid Row is not a very interesting place to talk about. You live in a world where you're literally void of emotion. I don't remember having any feelings anymore. I had drinking myself to the point where I had no tolerance for booze. You could hit me in the butt with a wet bar towel and I was drunk. You know, it made me totally ill. I couldn't go to work if I'd had a job. It didn't do anything for me emotionally or mentally anymore. It didn't make me believe I was going to be somebody the next day. What it actually does for people like me, it reaches down and strips you of all sense of hope. You live in a world of hopelessness. Webster says that someone who has hope is a person who sincerely believes you'll succeed tomorrow where you fail today. And when you become a hopeless individual, you absolutely know every day for the rest of your life will be like today. And back in that time of my life, in that time of our era of time, you know, there seemingly was no help for people like me. If there was no, I didn't know it and neither did they. And that's the awfulest feeling in the world, that sense of hopelessness. I was out in California sometime this year, a friend of mine doing a thing, and he sponsored a whole bunch of young people, and one of those young guys called me and asked me to stay over on Sunday. They were responsible for the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on Skid Row in Los Angeles that Sunday night, and they said, stay over and go with us. And I said, sure, I stayed over and went with them. And I went to Skid Row in Los Angeles to that AA meeting those young guys put on out there, you know. And when I got to Skid Row at that meeting, there was literally hundreds of people there on Skid Row. You know, that's the first thing I saw. The first thing I saw was that sense of hopelessness that's in their eyes. And you know, you see a lot of that in newcomers that come to AA. That have anything to do with Skid Row. It's a sense of hopelessness. You know, that nothing, nothing will ever be better than it is now. And they know that because they've tried. They've tried with great determination and failed. You know, literally, did they know they tried it their way? That don't work. But you know, I told those guys on Skid Row, that's what I saw. I saw that in their face. You know, I saw that in their face, that sense of hopelessness. And in Greek mythology, it says that at the gates of hell stands a three-headed dog called Cerebus. And Cerebus says, whoever enters the gates of hell will never again be allowed to return to the land of hope. And I said, I just want you to understand that that Greek mythology was written a long time before Alcoholics Anonymous comes along. Because Alcoholics Anonymous says, no matter how many times you've been to the gates of hell, and no matter how far in you went, and no matter how long you stayed, there is a sense of hope here in this program. And you can experience it. I knew I would die in that alley. Not an interesting place, Skid Row. I live in an alley that there was a hardware store in front of it and a couple of beer joints and that. And we survived by this hardware store would throw out those cardboard boxes. And it's sort of an ego builder. If you'd get there early and get one of them big freezer boxes, you can lay down in them. And you look at some guy trying to curl up in one of them old console TV boxes. You know you're better than he is. You know, you think, I think they ought to get rid of him. He's ruining the neighborhood. Yeah, it's just not a very interesting place to talk about. But I tell you what, if you got to go there, remember that. It's the greatest insulator in the world from the elements of weather, cardboard. We had a beautiful cardboard condominium complex back there in that alley. And if you're new in AA, you might want to write that down. It's CARDBOARD. Keep that in your wallet. It's a big help. And the people you meet on Skid Row are not very interesting. They're dumber than hell, especially cops. I don't know if there's any policemen here. But I think, you know, they ask you some of the stupidest questions on Skid Row. They've been educated in those academies, and they got those big squad cars and five-cell flashlights and them nightsticks and a gun. People are getting raped, robbed, mugged, burglarized out in the city, and they're riding down alleys hunting winos. They see you sitting in a cardboard box, and they bail out of that squad car and throw that five-cell flashlight in your eyes, ask you the dumbest question you will ever be asked as long as you live. They say, what are you doing? And you say, nothing. And they lock you up. I've often said I wished I'd have known something about alcoholism when they said, what are you doing? You could have said, officer, I'm progressing. You know? I was, rapidly. Guy in my finance company was hunting me in that alley. Borrowed some money from him about a year, never paid him a dime. They don't like that. Some bartender squealed on me, said, go back there and look in that cardboard jungle. He'll be back there somewhere. Another dummy. You know, another dummy. Guy in a suit and a tie back in that wine old cardboard condominium complex. And he looked around through there and saw me sitting in one of them freezer boxes. I had a pint of wine, a three-day-old racing for him, and he falls dressed up in a suit and a tie, nervous as hell, as you can imagine. And he finally got enough nerve when he saw me sitting there, and he come over and he knocked on my box. And you know, I opened the flap to let him in, and he said, asked me about Jack Sullivan. I said, yeah. And he said, Told me who he was. He said, you borrowed some money from us about a year and a half ago, and you have not paid one damn nickel on it. I said, yeah. He said, I'm going to tell you something, boy. If you don't start making some payments on that loan, you're going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble. Yeah, I don't know what he meant. I still don't know what he meant. You know, this day. Knew I'd die there. No escape. Morning of the 21st day of August of 1962, my life was to change. I had absolutely no idea that morning when I woke up or came to and I hustled a guy for a half a dollar to get me one of them little fiddles of wine, that my life would change that day. I was sitting in the back room of that beer joint that a friend of mine owned and run. He let us in there once in a while. I was a pitiful looking piece of human flesh. I had a long hair and a beard. All my teeth had been kicked out. I suffered from malnutrition and dehydration, which causes you to change colors and bloat. You know, and it's just a pitiful looking piece of human flesh with all that I could tell you I was. And the back door of that saloon opened where I was, and my father walked in with a man I'd never seen before in my life. And I hadn't seen my father in a long time. And I wanted to run, I wanted to hide, because I didn't want my father to see me the way that I looked. You know? And this guy offered to help me that was with him. He came to the table where I sat, a very distinguished looking man, white hair, shirt and a tie and a suit on. Very handsome looking guy, and my father was sitting on some stools around a lunch counter, and the guy come over and he stuck his hand out, wanted to shake hands with me. He said, hi, my name is Jack. I understand so is yours. I said, yes. He said, I've come out here to help you. I hope you'll let me. I can't help you if you won't let me. Isn't that true for everybody? I can't help you if you won't let me. It's nothing to do with Skid Row. It's something to do with anywhere. You know? I looked at him and I couldn't understand why he was there or who he was. I said, why, stranger, would you want to help me? I don't even know you. Why would you care about me? He said, I've come here because I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me, and that's why I'm here, he said. I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me, and that's why I'm here, he said. That's why I'm here. I go to five AA meetings a week in Louisville. I go because I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. And my willingness to share that and pass it on is what keeps me with some degree of sanity and recognition of where I came from. And at the same time, I know it's very beneficial to you. And if you can accept that, it will be very beneficial to somebody else, because I'm sure you will pass it on. But that's why I go, and that's why I do what I do. Skid Row, from Skid Row to here, unbelievable journey. Unbelievable. I've never regretted my life. And I say that because I never married. I never had any children. And I left a home and went to live in a city gutter. And I think I'm the luckiest human being in the world, because I've seen oh so many of you who go out and get a gutter and take it home with you. I've seen some of the stinkinest, filthiest gutters running down through the middle of living rooms of some of the finest homes in the country. I've seen alcoholics in their sick minds, honestly to God, believing that the people that loved them the most were in some way responsible for what they had become. I've seen alcoholics reach out of their living room gutters and grab beautiful wives and husbands and children and parents and drag them through that stinking emotional mess of garbage that alcoholism breeds. And I've seen you teach them well. And I've seen you teach them how to be lonely and insecure and afraid. Right in your own living rooms. Right in your own gutters. It's a hell of a lot easier to not have a wife or a child or a parent and go live in a city gutter than it is to take one home with you. And the man said to me, I've made arrangements to have you admitted to Our Lady of Peace Hospital, which was a psychiatric hospital in Louisville. Back in 1962, where I come from, you couldn't get alcoholics anywhere. Up here, you could. Down there, you couldn't. It's fascinating sometimes when you look at what was going on in certain parts of the country with medicine and psychiatry and sociology and wasn't anything going on down the road. But they would get you admitted to psychiatric hospital under certain conditions. And this guy had a friend who was a psychiatrist, and he agreed to admit me. Psychiatry did not believe in alcoholism as a primary sickness. And I don't stand here tonight being critical of that. I'm only telling you what they believed. I believe if you believed that to be true, they did, then I can't do anything to criticize them. The only thing I can tell you is they were absolutely wrong. They knew that alcoholism was a secondary illness. It was a symptom of some underlying emotional disorder. Psychiatry knew that all alcoholics would be better if they would bring their Valium deficiency up. I'm serious. If they could restore your Valium levels back to their proper place, you'd be okay. Long before General Electric ever thought about it, they knew you could live better electrically. They'd hook those electrodes to your head and buzz you. They came up with a brilliant conclusion that alcoholics were depressed and that electricity alleviated the depressive ruts of your mind. Alcoholics are depressed. Wasn't that a brilliant conclusion? What we get into would depress a rhinoceros. And then they also had another thing I thought was kind of stupid. They wanted you to go to group therapy with other people. I always went to group therapy by myself. Hell, all of you did. Did you ever ride down the street in a car and have a committee meeting in there? Nobody in there but you? I think I'll stop over and get me a beer. You better not. Why? You know what happened last week. Well, it'd be different today, you know. Committee meeting going on in there. Nobody in there but you. When they said to me in that hospital, we're going to have group therapy, I went and got in the closet. I know it ain't different. Well, I was sitting in there for a week talking to that doctor, and I got to feeling a little bit better. You know how we are in a week's time, that good medicine, and kind of coming back a little bit and getting ready, or I'm ready. I've been ready before. A nurse come in there that morning on the 28th day of August and informed me not to go anywhere that night. We were going to the AA meeting. I said, what in the hell is an AA meeting? I never heard of AA. She said, it's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, are you insinuating you think I'm an alcoholic? She said, no, I'm not insinuating anything. I said, I'll have you know that I'm no damned alcoholic. She smiled. I said, I'll have you know that if you're not one, there ain't any. I said, I'm not going to any AA meeting. She said, you'll be back there with me tonight, or I'll put you over there in a room that's padded walls and the doorknob is on the outside of the door. Now, if you've never been in a psychiatric institution, I'm here to tell you, they have architectural defects in them. Some doors have one knob, it ain't on your side. So I thought, well, I believe I'll go, but I didn't want to. I'd been in there for a week, and I'd fallen in love with another woman alcoholic, and it was beautiful relationship. I mean, you see it all the time. You ever go in these treatment centers where they're holding hands and blinking eyes at each other, and they can't wait till they get out of there, and a lot of times they don't wait till they get out of there. The only thing I know is dumber than that is somebody works there and tries to separate them. I'm serious. If you work in one of them joints and you got two drunks in love, you leave them alone. Encourage them to stay together. If you separate them, they'll screw up four people. They're just kind of meant for each other. Well, I said that, nurse. I guess I'll go to your damn AA meeting, but I'm no alcoholic. And she said, well, maybe you could be wrong about that. Wrong? Nothing wrong in an alcoholic's vocabulary. I said, wrong? I don't ever remember being wrong. Everything that's happened in my life was their fault. If it wasn't for them, if they'd leave me alone, I'd be okay. My philosophy of life. I accept no responsibility for anything, and I'll tell you one damn thing, I'm not wrong, and if you caught me dead-handed, I'd figure a way to get out of it. Billy Moore told me about an alcoholic cowboy out west his grandfather knew, and it's a true story, because Billy told me. you don't look like you're believing. Billy said he knew that alcoholic grandfather, knew that alcoholic cowboy out west, and old cowboy drunk one day, come out of a saloon and drunker than hell, and an old man rode in town on a mule. When that old man got off that mule, that alcoholic cowboy run out there with a six-shooter and asked that old man if he could dance. That old man said, no, I don't know nothing about dancing. And the alcoholic cowboy whipped his gun out and started shooting at that old man's feet. And old man got to dancing. When that alcoholic cowboy fired that sixth bullet out of that gun, that old man reached up on the back of that mule and got a shotgun. He stuck it in that alcoholic's face. He said, did you ever kiss a mule's ass? He said, no, but I've always wanted to. No, but I've always wanted to. The lengths will go, you know, not to be wrong. And I told that nurse, ain't nothing wrong with me. Them. Looking for the culprit? Go get them. Not me. Not me. Billy Moore had a brother-in-law one time who was an alcoholic and never did get sober. But he blamed everything on everybody else. Billy said that guy come down the street one day, had both of his ears burned. And Billy said he looked at him and said, how in the name of God could a man burn both of his ears? He said, I went home last night and I was drinking. And he said, my wife was ironing. We got an argument and the phone rang. And he said, I reached over and picked that damn iron up and stuck it up my ear. And Billy said, well, that's how you burn your left ear. How in the hell did you burn your right ear? He said, that son of a bitch called back. It ain't your fault. Well, that nurse come got me that night, had me by my earlobe, took me down a corridor to a student nurse's classroom where they held their AA meeting. Interestingly enough, the first AA meeting ever held in that hospital was held the 21st of August, 62. I didn't make that one, and they didn't start it for me. It just worked out that way. But I was going to the second one because that nurse had me by my ear and threatened to lock me up, and I didn't want to go, and she took me down that damn corridor to the student nurse's classroom, and in that doorway stood a damned old woman, gray-haired lady. She was a pretty lady. She's about 60 years old, and man, that's old. You know, and that nurse has got me by the ear, and she said, Marguerite, it was Marguerite Bibbins standing in that doorway, said, Marguerite, this is Jack Sullivan. He wants to come to your AA meeting. I said, I don't want to come to your damned AA meeting. She makes me come back here. Threatened to lock me up if I didn't come. But I sure as hell don't want to come. And Marguerite smiled and put her arm around my shoulder, called me honey. She said, now, honey, you calm down. You'll be okay. You might even like our meeting. She said, honey, would you like a cup of coffee and a cookie? Ain't that a hell of a thing to offer a macho drunk from 4th and Central a cup of coffee and a cookie? I'd been in there about a week and feeling better. I was thinking about a half pint and a hooker. Well, in I went and sat down and I listened to some old fool get up here and talk like I am tonight, trying to share with me a story that every alcoholic I ever met's got. I tried it out there my way, baby. It damn near killed me. I did it for 30 years, or I did it for 20 years, or 10 years, or 5 years. It kept getting worse and worse and worse. I couldn't do a damn thing about it, and I finally came here and I found somebody that could help me. That's all he said, although he talked for an hour. I interrupted him, made an ass out of myself, you wouldn't believe. They tried to shut me up. I wouldn't shut up. I figured if he wanted to tell me his story, I'm going to tell him mine. And I hope they thoroughly understood it was not my fault what was wrong with me. And they didn't seem to much care. And that hurt. And finally, the meeting was over, and I tried to get out that door, and that old woman grabbed me. You know, put her arm around my shoulder and called me honey. I mean, I made an ass out of myself in there you wouldn't believe. She said, now, honey, you'll be okay. She said, you come back here next week now because Alcoholics Anonymous needs people like you. I thought they ought to put that old broad in a home somewhere and get her off of the street. Well, I went back the next week, sat down next to an old man, again. It's going to change my life. I had no idea. There was a guy sitting up behind the desk named Jim Krishan. There was an old man sitting in that audience named Hillary Sanders, and they both were to change my life. Jim was a very gentle man. Hillary was a very gruff old guy. They were to become my sponsors. I've always said everybody in AA ought to get two sponsors, a soul saver and an ass kicker. Yeah. I had one each. Yeah. And I sat down next to Hillary, and he said, "Hi, boy, how you doing?" I didn't like him calling me boy. And I didn't think it was any of his business how I was doing. I'd seen him there the week before, but he did not work there. It was none of his business how I was getting along. And I thought it took a lot of damn nerve to ask. Then I looked at him again, and he was old. He was in his 60s. And I said to myself, "You ought to be nice to old people." I really believe that today. I said, "I'm doing all right, old man, but I ain't no damn alcoholic." He said, "Really?" I said, "Really." He said, "Well, if you ever find out what's wrong with you, you ought to do something about it. You look like hell." I thought, "Well, you old fool." I got up and left and went back and listened to that psychiatrist, listened to them guys in AA. They transferred me out of there, sent me down to a nut house in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Western State Hospital was the only place in the state of Kentucky that had an alcoholic ward. You people up here don't know how lucky you are. In Madison, Indiana was the only place that had an alcoholic ward in Indiana. That was in a state mental institution. You think you got low self-esteem? Go to a nut house and the patients don't want you. I'm serious. They'd give them drunks hell down there. You'd hear people walking the grounds. These are insane people that have been there for a while. "They brought them drunks down here, Martha." "I know it. I know it. And I don't know why they brought them here. We don't want them." I had an uncle who was a drunk. A damn troublemaker was all he was. I wish to hell they'd take them somewhere else. Why did they bring them here where we got to put up with them? Now, these are crazy people. No, talking about you. No. I mean, it really doesn't do anything for your self-esteem. No. They didn't want you there. And it was an interesting place. They tried to encourage you to get in AA and listen to what they had to say and that kind of thing. I was what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous calls a defiant drunk. I didn't want to hear that stuff. And I kept that shield up. And the interesting thing about it, looking back on it today and with some of the people that I sponsor and deal with and run with, you can see that in people where you know if you can keep them here, that'll change. They were firm believers that nothing changes until you change. You hear people say, "Don't drink, go to meetings, read the book." They never said that. You know, they said, "Books make you think." You don't need to think. I'll give you a book when you're ready for a book. Just do what the hell I tell you. Somebody asked Wino Joe one time to put a workshop on sponsorship. Joe said, "How in the hell would you do that? You can't talk for an hour on sponsorship. You talk for 30 seconds on sponsorship." Joe said, "Sponsorship consists of I talk and you listen. And that's it." You know, and that's what they did. I came back to live with my sister in Louisville, and my dad said one day, "We're going out and get you some decent clothes, and I'm taking you back to Our Lady of Peace Hospital Tuesday night, and Hillary Sanders will bring you home." I said, "Hillary Sanders? How do you know Hillary Sanders?" He said, "Don't you worry about how I know him. He'll bring you home." And I went up there that night, and Hillary brought me home. He said, "You be out here in this driveway tomorrow night, and Leo Schoenbacher will pick you up. You be here at 7 o'clock, he's going to take you to a meeting." I was there, and he took me. And Leo brought me home, and he said, "You be out there in this driveway tomorrow night, and George Semenser is going to pick you up and take you to a meeting." And I was out there in that driveway, and George dropped me off, and he said, "You be out here in that driveway tomorrow night. Hillary's going to come by." And I thought, what in the name of God is wrong with these people? Do they think that's all in the hell I got to do is go to these damn meetings? I have things to catch up on. So Hillary pulled in the driveway that night, and I went out there and said, "Listen, Hillary," he said, "get in the car." I said, "You're not listening to me." He said, "Get in the car." I said, "Hillary, you're not paying attention. I have things to do, And he got out of the car and he said, I am not telling you again. Get in the damn car. I thought for the first 4 years I was sober, the first step in AA was get in the car. I tell people today, don't drink, go to meetings, get in the car. Them kids tell me that. I'll be by, get in the car. You know, if you don't drink, go to meetings, get in the car, you'll do well. I got in that damn car about 366 days the first year I was sober. And them guys began to lead me into a program which saved my life. They took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous very gently. You know, and they did that, and I'm the same way with people today. They did that by, I want to hear your side of the story. You know, if I sponsor you, I say, come on, boy, sit down and tell me about yourself, how good you're doing. You know, I mean, you talk about something that's ridiculous when you lay that out there, and you have to look at it. Pilots over alcohol, they weren't concerned about I got drunk certain times when I drank it, didn't control. They were talking about where it took me and how long I had to stay. I didn't make a move without booze. An unmanageable life? Absolutely. What kind of person was I sober? The unmanageability in my life was I became restless, irritable, and discontented. Sober. And they wanted to see me change that attitude from that defiance to acceptance. And they tolerated me that long. A power greater than me, insanity? I told him one day, I'm not crazy. He said, you're crazy as a loon. You know, the insanity in Alcoholics Anonymous was not what you saw in that nut house down there at Western State Hospital. The thing that makes you crazy is you can't see yourself. You are so dishonest with what kind of a person you really are, it makes you totally insane. And that old man told me, he said, I'm going to pass something on to you, boy. If you're looking for sanity, the day they bury you, you will be as sane as you are honest. Whatever degree of honesty you attain in a lifetime, you'll have the same degree of sanity when it comes to that mirror. And when you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't see that. You totally and utterly depend upon other people to see that and to tell you the truth about yourself. I had no God in my life, and I told him that. You know, I don't believe in God. I never did believe in God, and I want you to understand that, old man. And he said, so what? I said, you didn't hear me. I don't believe in God. He said, I couldn't care less what you believe in. I said, how about God? He said, he cares less than I do. How long can you be around here and remain dumb? You don't understand. You're a product of what you believe in. You are today a product of what you believe in. And all of that has to change. And when it changes, you remain a product of what you believe in. I am today because I believe in me, I believe in you, and I believe in God. The basis of this program, the triangle of this program is recovery, unity, and service. The program itself for you is the same triangle with God, yourself, and other people. And through that, the base is God, the sideboards are you and other people. And that love they talk about in AA flows from God to other people, to you, and back to God. And when you break that or have never had it, you can't have a decent life. There's absolutely no way you can have a decent life. I didn't know anything about love. I thought there was a bunch of weirdos in this program when they talked about love. Little did I ever understand that when an Alcoholics Anonymous, when they talk about love, if I say I love you, I don't love you for who you are. I love you for what I am when I'm with you. Because of you, I'm better. And maybe in some small way, because of me, you're better. But having no God was of no justification to me. I didn't understand God, and when somebody asked Bishop Sheen one time to define God, Bishop Sheen said that God was the intangible spirit of truth that lives in the hearts of people. The intangible spirit of truth. Want to make an alcoholic run? Tell him the truth. You remember the Nicholson movie, Few Good Men? What he told Tom Cruise? I want to hear the truth. He said, you can't handle the truth. I thought he was at an AA meeting. You know,
In the Phantom of the Opera, the phantom sings to the girl, and he says, close your eyes, for your eyes will only tell the truth, and the truth isn't what you want to see. In the darkness, it's easy to pretend that the truth is what it ought to be. Story of my life in two paragraphs. The truth was something I couldn't handle or see. And when I saw the truth about me, I didn't like it. And those old guys didn't give a damn whether I liked it or not. They were going to tell me anyway. And they prepare you for the steps that will the next one. You know, for the next one. And that was the glory part of my life, when I could implement those 12 steps into my life. They wanted you to be fearless and thorough when you took a 4-step, but fearless meant void of fear. Any psychiatrist, psychologist, sociologist in the world will tell you strongest emotion in your body is fear. Nothing stronger than fear. Nothing. Only thing known to overcome it is faith. Faith overcomes fear. The big book tells us to have faith, it must create a lot of self-sacrifice and a lot of action on your part. And what a great day it was in my life when I could live in a world fearlessly. I sobered 13 months. Gay and I got married. I got my job back with that railroad. The old man kept working on me. Finally gave me a book I could read. After he gave me that big book, I wanted one of them things you draw lines through it with. I didn't know what they called them, but I said to him, get me one of them things you draw lines with. I see people doing that all the time. When they read something in that book, it pertains to them. They draw a line through it. He said, you talking about a highlighter? I said, yeah, I want one of them. He said, a highlighter? I said, yeah. He said, let me understand it. You want something to draw a line through that big book. When it comes to you, it pertains to you? I said, yeah. He said, you don't want a highlighter. You need a 3-inch paintbrush. I never drew a damn line in a book in my life since then, you know. But I stayed with AA, and I went to work for that railroad. And in 1974, I started an alcohol and drug abuse program for a very large railroad, Global in Nashville. Stayed there until 1988. And then I retired. And Gay and I have had the greatest life in the world, you know. We've had a good life. And, you know, it's all because of what AA's done for us and what Al-Anon's done for us. And I love retirement. I don't do nothing. I'm good at it. I'm better at it than Cassini. Cassini's around here somewhere. I've done it. I'm better at it than he is. I don't do nothing. I follow a philosophy that Bum Phillips, that Houston Oilers football coach, had. Bum said when he retired, he didn't do nothing. And he started that at noon. And I believe that's good philosophy. I don't do nothing and start at noon. You know? But I go to my AA, and I sponsor people, and I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. I try to share what I can because I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me. It's made my life better, hopefully a lot of other people's better, and in some small way kept AA alive and healthy. I like to close every talk I make by telling you a story that I heard many years ago. It meant so much to me. It was about a man who was walking down a very cold and lonely road one night, and in the middle of the road laid a snake. And the snake looked at the man and spoke to him. He said, please, mister, pick me up and help me. Get me warm in order that I may live. If you leave me in this cold and on this road, I'll die. Please help me. The man says, I can't. You're a poisonous reptile. And surely to God, if I pick you up and put me under my coat and warm you, and you are restored to vitality, you'll bite me. And the snake said, I won't bite you if you save my life. The man picked him up and put him under his coat, and when the snake got warm, he bit him, and the man grabbed him and threw him out from his coat and back to the road. And he looked at the snake, and he said, I thought if you promised if I'd help you not to bite. And with a snickering grin on his face, the snake looked at him and said, you knew what I was when you picked me up. My friends, if you're somewhere in the confines of your own home, a bar, or wherever it may be, if it's your decision to take the cap off of the bottle or the cork out of the jug, try to justify it to those who are willing to listen. Try to explain it to those who want to hear. But if you've been here, if you know me and you've met us, you know what it is when you pick it up. Thank you for having me in Akron.